Unlike Buddhism or Hinduism, Taoism is a strange name in this country. In fact, it's even difficult to know how to pronounce it, because although it is often spelt with a T, T-A-O-I-S-M, it is usually pronounced as though it were a D, the result of which some people write it with a D. As long as you know that when we're talking about T or D-A-O-I-S-M, whether we pronounce it Taoism or Taoism, we're talking about the same thing, then we shan't go far astray. It is one of the most ancient philosophies of China, and has had in China a big influence on other philosophies, particularly Confucius. So what is it then? What is the Tao? Well, we get the name from primarily, and the information or understanding of it primarily from a book called the Tao Te Ching, T-A-O-T-E-C-H-I-N-G, pronounced Tao Te Ching. The Jing bit simply means a classic. It means that this is a very important piece of writing. The Tao is the word we're looking at, and the De means the power of the Tao in an individual life. So how can we define the Tao? Well, we have a problem right from the start, because if we look at the Tao Te Ching, the very first sentence, or first two sentences in it, say this: the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. So there is a problem. We can't name it. We can't talk about it. So how can one proceed to give a lecture on it? Well, I think we can say some things about the Tao, which won't be confusing. It is the mysterious underlying source of the universe. Now, you might say, well, in that case, it's a bit like the Hindu view of Brahman, or even the Christian view of God. Well, not quite. The Tao is more remote than either Brahman or God in these other religions. The Tao is certainly the power which brought the universe eventually into being, but the Tao itself is unknown, and at least directly unknown, and unknowable. In Hinduism, the belief is that the individual Atman or self can be united with the Brahman. And of course, Christianity speaks about a relationship between the individual and God. You cannot have a relationship with the Tao. The Tao is mysterious, unformed, remote. So how do we then learn about the Tao? Well, the Tao Te Ching has a statement that tells us how the process actually took place. And it's in section 42 of this book. If you haven't got the Tao Te Ching, incidentally, I suggest you put it on your list of books to buy. There are a lot of translations in English. Any self-respecting bookshop will have a copy. And you'll find then that I can talk about a chapter, but the chapters are less than one page. So perhaps section is the right one. And this is section 42, and this is what it says. The Tao gives birth to the One. The One gives birth to the Two. The Two give birth to the Three. The Three give birth to every living thing. It then goes on to say, all things are held in yin and carry yang, and they are held together in the qi of teeming energy. Now that's quite a complicated statement, so let's just go through it. The Tao gives birth to the One. The One is qi, or primordial breath, or spirit. The word qi can be translated either as breath or spirit. It's the life force that is breathed into every living creature. It's rather similar to the Hebrew word ruach, which is the word used in the Old Testament for spirit, but that also can mean wind or breath. The breath of God breathed upon the water, says the book of Genesis, and the same concept comes through in Taoism, that there was this primordial breath which started the first developments that were to produce everything that is in the world, in the universe. So that is the qi. The one gives birth to the two. Well, the two to which the qi gives birth are, as is mentioned later in that passage, the yin and the yang. I'll come back to the yin and the yang in a minute, but I can say just now that the yin is the negative force, the yang is the positive. And the concept behind the yin-yang philosophy is that the whole of the world is, as it were, on a pendulum, going backwards and forwards. Partaking partly of the negative, partly of the positive, partly of cold, partly of heat, partly water, partly fire, feminine and masculine, and so on, submissive and assertive. And the whole of life is held within this balance between these two extremes, which ultimately are united with each other. So those are the two, and the two give birth to the three. The three are earth, heaven and humanity. Earth, heaven and humanity. And the three give birth to every living thing. The Chinese phrase literally means to the 10,000 things, rather a very quaint phrase that, meaning everything that exists comes into being as a result of either earth or heaven or humanity. So that is the order. The Tao is unknowable, but it is expressed, so far as our uttermost origins are concerned, through the primeval qi or breath or spirit, which still flows through the world, and this spirit is then expressed through the yin and the yang, and the yin and the yang produce the world, heaven, ourselves, and thus eventually everything that exists. So there we've got the picture that we can. If we talk about the Tao, then we're not really talking about the ultimate source of the universe. We can talk about the qi, the breath which brought life out of sterility or deadness, that we can talk about. And certainly we can talk about the forces of yin and yang. But to talk about the Tao is impossible. And yet, none of anything that we see around us would be there, would exist, would be, if it were not for the Tao. And Taoism is simply arguing that really our lives should be lived in harmony with the Tao. And the person whose life is in such harmony has got the day, the power of the Tao in his or her life. Hence Tao De Ching, the classic of the Tao and its power, meaning power in the individual life. So the purpose of Taoism, according to this philosophy, is to be at one with the ground of being, if I can call it that, the unknown and unknowable ground of being. And a person who lives his life in accordance with the Tao will find a harmony, a sense of peace with himself or herself, a oneness with the whole of the creation, not just with other human beings, but with the rest of the natural world around him. In fact, that person will have found out what it is to be a human being because he or she is being natural. Now just hold on to that word for a bit, the word natural. It's a very important word in Taoism. Taoism doesn't impose all kinds of theological or even philosophical concepts. Like all Chinese writing, it's done in pictorially, of course, the ancient Chinese script. So it is not using complicated philosophical words at all. It is talking in simple, which doesn't mean stupid, nor does it mean childish. Simple means basic, understandable, comprehensible to all. And this for me at any rate, is the great strength of Taoism, that a child can come to it, and it, this is perhaps the paradox, a child can come to read the Tao Te Ching and perhaps make more of it than an adult, because there are certain very mysterious aspects of the Tao which the Tao Te Ching expresses. Here's one, for example, section 25. Before the world was, and the sky was filled with stars, there was a strange, unfathomable body. This being, this body, is silent, and beyond all substance and sensing. It stretches beyond everything, spanning the empyrean. It has always been here, and it always will be. Everything comes from it, and then it is the mother of everything. I do not know its name, so I call it Tao. Now that is the mysterious, underlying, unknowable force which is the Tao. All right then, can we say anything about the way Taoist philosophy sees how we could so shape our lives that we are in harmony with the Tao? Now here, it's rather interesting this, that with Buddhism I had to say something similar, and with Hinduism, and with Christianity, that there are two or more, but in this case two, distinct branches of Taoism. There is, first of all, what is known as religious Taoism, which is called Tao Jiao, that's T-A-O-C-H-A-I-O. And then there is Tao Chia, which is Tao C-H-I-A. I think I said A-I-O a moment ago. I should have said I-A-O, C-H-I-A-O, Tao Jiao. That is religious Taoism. And Tao Chia, C-H-I-A, is philosophical Taoism. Now, in a lecture on religion, you'd have thought that probably I would spend most of the time on the religious Taoism, but it has taken a rather strange form, or strange at any rate to our Western way of thinking. Its real aim is to extend life of each individual here on Earth, so that each person can aim to become what they call a Xian, H-S-I-E-N, an immortal. And it is immortality here on Earth that they are looking for. And legends among religious Taoists are that there are people around who have lived for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And there are all sorts of practices that they advocate in order to extend your life, such as certain exercises, physical exercises. And a particular one which is very distinctive in this form of Taoism is embryonic breathing, where you breathe, as it were, not with your lungs, but much deeper in the body, further down, and the breath goes right round, so they believe, all your body, thus giving it the more strength and able to sustain it. And there were many schools of this. Some of them, you may have read or heard of some of the ideas they have about sex as a means of men and women strengthening each other through the sexual relationship and lengthening their lives. It has got into alchemy as well, and to be honest, it is not an area that is, interesting though it is, fascinating though it is, that fits in very closely with the other lectures that we're doing in this series. And I intend, therefore, without discounting religious Taoism at all, to concentrate on philosophical Taoism, and to look at some of the concepts that come there, because in the writings that we've got, they are quite clearly in this school of Taoism, rather than, though not exclusively, but rather than in the religious Taoist school. There are two or three words that I can introduce to you, and they're all mercifully short. And one key word, or it's a hyphenated word, is Wu Wei. That's W-U hyphen W-E-I, Wu Wei, often translated as doing nothing. Now, very often this is the case, that one does nothing in order to be successful one doesn't always have to be doing something, but sometimes one does have to be doing something. And we've got to be more precise about our understanding of this very important Chinese concept. Wu Wei means taking only action that is appropriate to the situation. Speaking only when the time is ripe. Acting only when the force is with you, if you like. It means being able to intuitively to know when is the right moment to step out. And maybe by waiting and waiting and waiting, you find that no action is actually needed at all, that the situation that you were perhaps getting all worried about has resolved itself. This would be very basic to Taoist teaching, that most of the things that seem to be overwhelming problems at the time, if we wait patiently, will solve themselves, evaporate, disappear, leaving us wondering what on earth we were concerned about in the first place. Now, there is much in the Tao Te Ching about this, but the man who really brought out this concept of Wu Wei was probably the most famous historical figure in Taoism, namely Chuang Tzu. Now again, there are different spellings of his name, but I'm going to give you the traditional spelling, Chuang Tzu, 3rd century BCE, Chuang hyphen Tzu. Tzu is a word, Tzu means master or teacher. It's a word of respect used of anybody who has been giving insights to others and is accepted as having something worth listening to. And Chuang Tzu is, as I say, the most famous historical Taoist. Now, those of you who have read anything about Taoism will say, well, what about Lao Tzu, the author of the Tao Te Ching? Wasn't he earlier than Chuang Tzu? Well, if there had been a Lao Tzu, he would certainly have been earlier than Chuang Tzu. But a lot of debate as to whether the Tao Te Ching was the product of one author. The legend has it that this man, this remarkable figure of Lao Tzu, tired of all the materialism of the society in which he lived and decided to leave the city and go out into the wilderness and become a recluse. And he was met at the door to the city and recognized by the man at the gate there, who asked would he please leave a sort of final message to help the rest who were now going to be deprived of his wisdom. And he very quickly wrote the 80 sections of the Tao Te Ching. But Lao Tzu simply means great master. It's obviously a title, and many, in fact, I think the majority of modern sinologists, that is to say people who study Chinese history and culture and philosophy, are quite convinced that the Tao Te Ching is in fact a compilation over several centuries and put together probably about the 2nd century BCE. It does seem to reflect different writers. So the one historical figure in Taoism that we can be sure about is Chuang Tzu, whose writings were only translated into English in the late 19th century. And it is he who makes a great deal of this Wu Wei. He argues that to act at the wrong time will do more harm than good. There is a time for speech, a time for silence, says the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, book of Ecclesiasticus, I should say. And he would have agreed with that we wait until the right moment, and then our strength will be as the strength of 10. Otherwise, said Chuang Tzu, and he's fond of very colourful imagery, if we, to speak out at the wrong time is, or to act at the wrong time is like flaying the air. He was fond of this phrase, flaying the air. A lot of the things we argue about, discuss, we're not going to change the situation. We might get hot under the collar about all sorts of issues, but we can't change it. So Chuang Tzu says, what is the point of wasting your energy on something that you're completely incapable of doing anything about? Why not get on with the things that you can do something about? And it is this ability to intuitively know that now is the time that is the key to Wu Wei, which is, as I say, one of the central features of Taoism. It is being, in the phrase of a late 19th, early 20th century existentialist, actually, Paul Tillich, who said one must learn to discern the signs of the times. Well, Chuang Tzu would have agreed with that. And you say the trouble with most people is they speak out on all sorts of issues and make no contribution to them. And then when something perhaps comes along that they really feel about and can make some contribution to, they've exhausted themselves on what they couldn't do anything about anyway. So he stands out, I think, as one of the most, to my mind anyway, one of the most fascinating thinkers and teachers that the world has produced. He would have been a supporter of the philosophy, never do today what can possibly be left till tomorrow. The word, key word there, of course, being possibly. To hurry around, trying to do things that can be left, instead of seeking the inner calmness that will enable you to do the job far better anyway. To him, that was a key factor in life. So that is Wu Wei. It's often described as non-violence, bowing, as it were, to the wind, not standing up and in a confrontational attitude towards anything that you disagree with. All these things, all these qualities, all have a part in Wu Wei. Now, I'd like to introduce you to one or two other words, and as I say, they are very short. In fact, the next one is just two letters. It's Fu, F-U, Fu, which means to return, and the Tao Te Ching says returning is the way of the Tao, returning. Now, there are two ways in which you can imply this idea of returning, and the first is with the yin and the yang, and perhaps I'd better say a word or two about yin and yang now. The concept of yin and yang is that this is how the whole universe is run, these two extremes which together produce unity and harmony. Night follows day, which follows night, which follows day. You cannot have night without day. Can't have darkness without light. You only understand the word dark because of its opposite, light. If the light was always the same everywhere, then the words dark and light would not exist, any more than if everybody was the same height, the word tall or short would not exist. Not in terms of people's height, anyway. If the temperature everywhere on the Earth's surface were at all times the same, then the words hot and cold would not exist. We only know the meaning of the word hot because of its opposite, cold, and vice versa. And we can go through the whole lot. Chuang Tzu argued that we only know we're alive because we were once dead. If we were eternal and there never had been a time when we could not recall living on the earth, then the word living wouldn't exist at all. We wouldn't know what it was to live because we would have nothing with which to contrast it. And it is in this contrasting that the essence is found, according to the yin-yang philosophy. Now, it applies in all sorts of spheres. So the Chinese apply yin and yang to healing, and homeopathy is based on that, treating like with like, because they believe there are yin organs and yang organs, and one must therefore find the right partner for these particular organs in the prescription that is given to a patient. There are yin foods and yang foods. The yin foods, I suppose, are mostly those that a vegetarian would eat. The yang foods, obviously the proteins and so on. And I think a Taoist would have been one of the first to say a man or a woman is what he or she eats. I think any Taoist, looking at the kind of food that was eaten in California, where I used to go as an exchange professor, to go walk down some of the roads in California at breakfast time, around about 7 o'clock in the morning, and to see everybody sitting as they could, of course, in California, because the sun actually shone there, to see them sitting having their breakfast at 7 o'clock, which was a huge T-bone steak, which pretty well covered the whole of the table, and that this was just their breakfast. At lunch they'd have a similar one, at dinner another one. A Taoist looking at that would say, that is a violent people. They're bound to be violent. If that is the kind of food they're eating, it must be measured. It must be the intake of all this yang food is going to produce violence. On the other hand, let's not kid ourselves about this, the Chinese would be equally condemnatory of somebody who lived entirely on yin foods. They would say that person will not have enough strength. You've got to balance the two, the yin and the yang. I remember a colleague who was a vegan, lived on fruit, vegetables and nuts, and not so many of them. And quite honestly, I think if anybody blew him, just gave him a blow out of your mouth, a blow of wind, he'd fall down, fall flat on his back. So the two need to be balanced. And this is why in China, whereas in India the ideal would be a guru, the ideal Taoist in China would just as likely be a chef. The Chinese are more down to earth than the Indians on this, on the people of India on this one. They recognize that this harmony that they're trying to seek expresses itself in physical things as well as in what we call spiritual. So Fu, in one sense then, is harmonizing yourself with the yin and the yang. And if we were talking about this separately, which we haven't got time to do today, I would argue that to get this right is going to be a key to whether you're really living successfully or not. To know when the yin is in the ascendant or when the yang is in the ascendant. To know when the sort of way to proceed is gently, gently does it, doucement, doucement. And then to know also when to be assertive. This is incredibly important in terms of living successfully. I would argue that any successful marriage between a man and a woman will be the extent to which they each realize how far either one of them expresses in any particular aspect of the relationship the yin factor and how far the one represents the yang factor. See, I talked about the feminine and the masculine in the yin and the yang, and the two do indeed complement each other. But I use feminine and masculine rather than female and male. The female is a female and the male is a male, but the female will have some masculine qualities and the male some feminine qualities. We're beginning to understand more about this in recent years. Men are being asked to look for the feminine side of their natures. And I would argue that the most successful marriage is not one where they're both trying to be yang all the time, the dominant one. That will make marriage a battlefield. Nor is it one where they're trying to be yin all the time, the submissive one. That would make their marriage a graveyard. It is one in which each partner realizes which area he or she is the yang for and in which area he or she is the yin. And the successful partnership in marriage will be where this has been worked out, and that neither will be wanting to leave it to the other all the time or to dominate the other all the time. And that where we've got that, then we've got the harmony. So I'm quoting these to show that this philosophy of yin-yang is not taking you out of this world into some other ethereal plane. Rather, it is encouraging you to cope with the stresses that we face day by day, and it being in tune with the forces. And this means, as I say, being open, it's really being open to the way the wind is blowing. We're back to the qi again, because the qi expresses itself through yin and yang, the way the wind is blowing, and being able to follow that in a natural way, to be going the way that nature is taking you. And this is a central image in Taoism, that you go with the flow. If ever you are unfortunate enough to fall into a whirlpool, Taoist advice would be don't fight it. Take a deep breath and let the pool whirl you round and take you out the other side. If you try to fight it, then you'll drown. And this is the case with so much other kind of imagery. The same kind of picture is given where you're aligning yourself with the natural forces that are around you. I think, for example, of a champion skier and coming down the slope. And of course, the ideal as the skier comes down this slope is not to disturb even one flake of snow. Of course, that's the ideal. And it's not really going to happen, but the one who wins, usually by about a hundredth of a second, is the one who's disturbed least, and sometimes you can sense that, or feel almost, that this person coming down the slope is one at one with the slope, is part of the slope, and the ideal is to one who knows exactly when the next bend is coming, and exactly how to prepare himself and his body to fit in with the bend, to fit in with it, to go with the flow. And where that happens, and any musician will tell you this, that once the flow, as it were, has seized him, or he's part of it, that then things will go remarkably better than when the flow is not there, or when he's fighting against what is going on around him. The creative urge is one of achieving just that. One could give so many different examples, but this is the yin and the yang, and the fu that Taoism talks about is this returning, recognizing that the yin and the yang constantly approaching and then departing, and then approaching and departing, and life is lived on that kind of basis. So that's one expression of fu. The other one is very simply that the Chinese are very strong about being true to one's roots, returning to one's roots. Never tear up your roots would be the philosophy of Tao. Okay, this is not saying you must stay at home with your parents and your grandparents and so on and never actually physically leave them. This may well be a natural thing to do and necessary for anybody. But never to be so far from your roots that you become rootless, that you become, therefore, a wanderer, vaguely sort of looking for some kind of stability in life. If you remain true to your roots, then although you may be living physically far removed from those roots, they will still be part of you. In a way, it's really saying to be true, therefore, to yourself, not to try to pretend to be other than you actually are, not to put on a mask, not to what Jean-Paul Sartre, because I see a lot of parallels between the Western philosophy of existentialism and Taoism. Jean-Paul Sartre talked about having good faith with yourself, what he called good faith, not to pretend to be other than you really are. And particularly not to pretend to be something just because you think that will appeal to somebody else. If you're true to your roots, you're true to yourself, and you don't try to hide either who you are, where you come from, or what you are. And in a way, Chuang Tzu illustrates this perfectly. He didn't really seem to mind. He was always very gentle about it, but he didn't seem to mind what he said to anybody. And he was perfectly capable of saying no to even the most seductive of invitations. A famous occasion when he was visited by some dignitaries from the province where he lived and where he was some kind of civil servant. And they offered him the prime ministership of the province. And his reply was, "Well, gentlemen, you do me a great honour, but I have many times seen a pig fattened up and led to the slaughter. I don't wish to join them. And in any case, I think I got more important things to do than be Prime Minister of this province. And at the moment, the more important thing is to go fishing." With which he apparently said goodbye to them, picked up his fishing rod and went down to the stream at the bottom of his garden. Well, there are those who think that he's being too lazy. So I think the world is divided into those who think that Chuang Tzu was a great visionary and the great man for our time and all time, and those who think he was an absolute wastrel who was wasting his own talents. Well, the fact that we still remember him and his sayings have been collected and put together in the Chuang Tzu, and the fact that he was so respected by the people around that they were offered him the prime ministership of the country, shows that he wasn't becoming so heavenly minded that he was no earthly use. So he was, I think, a man who combined both the spiritual and the practical in his life. All right, well, that's the word fu. The next word is, it goes along with it, really, this being natural. It is pu, poo. And that literally means a rough-hewn piece of wood, a piece of wood in its natural state. And it is, the emphasis it gives as far as a human being is concerned is to be simple and natural. And you can see how this links up with what I've been saying. to be natural, not to try to do anything that is beyond the way nature has ordained things. Some people do try to improve on nature, and the Chinese are always giving pictures of this. There's one story of a small boy, a farmer's son, who came in one morning to his father with a few ears, or stalks rather, of very immature wheat. And his father said to him, "What have you got those for?" He says, "Well, I've been pulling the wheat so I can help it to grow." And the Tao Te Ching says, "Do you think you can improve on nature? I do not think it can be done. If you try to improve on it, you will harm it, and you will bring destruction on yourself." And in this being simple and natural, I think the Taoists are the forerunners of the green movement and all ecological concerns. They're simply saying that there is a harmony in nature, and that the only species that seems to want to break this harmony, destroy this harmony, is Homo sapiens, we human beings. And too many human beings have looked at nature and seen how they might chop it and change it, redirect it, try to make ground more fertile than it really is capable of being, and ultimately destroying the ground, trying to use a tiny bit of space to produce more creatures for the breakfast table or any other meal. The idea that you can speed up the laying of eggs by these artificial processes of these batteries, the battery chickens. The idea that you can make a field more fertile by pouring the poison, which is weed killer, on it, and then be surprised when ultimately the poison comes back through the soil to poison those who are going to eat the produce of that field. All this, without knowing anything of our modern methods, of course, ultra-modern methods, all this was understood by the Taoists, that there is the world. Your job is to work with it, not try to control it or to master it, because you are part of it. There's almost in Taoism the seeds of the Gaia hypothesis. The Gaia hypothesis that the world and Homo sapiens are all part of one huge organism, and that for one representative of that organism, i.e. Homo sapiens, to try to change the rest is an impertinence, to put it at its mildest. And Taoism would certainly have said that. So you do not try to improve on nature, you take things naturally. And if you are finding that, for example, you have to put weed killer down, or fly killer, insect killer down on your field, it is probably because you're being greedy and growing your crops in a part of the country which should not have crops, too near the water perhaps, which breeds insects. If you grew it in the right place, you wouldn't need to put the poison down. And even if you find that there are insects there, there's enough wheat for everybody, including some of the insects, and they wouldn't take it anything like so strongly as we seem to do with the thought that even 10% of a field's produce should be lost in this way. So there is the poo, the being simple, being natural, being without what we say in the Western world, without side, right, without pretense, without putting on any kind of airs of our own in order to enhance our image in the eyes of our neighbours. It is almost suggesting that we should try to practice innocence. You might say, how can we practice innocence when we've been around in the world for a bit? Well, that is perhaps the skill, to be innocent, not because of ignorance, as a child might be, a very small child, but still having faced the follies of the world, to maintain a certain innocence. Now there is something profound, something deep. This is how the Taoists would encourage you to live, to not to try to get on by being just as devious as anybody else. In a way, it's calling you to be childlike, and there's a big difference between being childlike and childish. the childlike person, like a child, if given a present, doesn't say, what is he doing that for? A child will accept a present for what it is, a gift, and that'll be that. Somebody came up to you and offered you £20, just like that, what would be your reaction? We are much more cynical, and Taoism is calling us to put aside cynicism and live more openly. Open to ourselves, open to one another, open to the natural world around us. So those are those three key words. I want to now just develop one of these ideas, which is this the sort of metaphysical side on it, because you might say, well, this is all very good, but does Taoism actually encourage you to find another side to life? Well, besides the material. It does, but not in the same way that Hindu or Buddhist meditation encourages it. There is the Tai Chi, which you may have seen. You may have seen on television people in old Peking and other cities in China who go out usually early in the morning, and some of them are very old indeed, and they seem to be putting their bodies into certain postures with one arm uplifted perhaps and the other one horizontal to the ground, and it may look as if nothing much is happening. Now, I can assure you couldn't be more wrong than that. A great deal is happening, and I have a relative who has been studying Tai Chi now for something like 25 years, and he reckons he's just about mastered the first stage of it. What you're doing, you see, the belief is that the Chi, the forces, these invisible forces, the primeval breath, but the force that the breath creates, these are flowing through the world. And that what you're doing in Tai Chi, therefore, is trying to find, you'll get your body aligned with these forces. And it is believed that this will give great beneficial, therapeutic, health-giving to anybody. Certainly, if you look at how old some of those people who practice Tai Chi are, it does seem to certainly prolong their lives. They think the same when that this applies even in the building of their houses. A Taoist would be very careful about the angle or the direction in which his house is built, because if it's in line with the Chi, then all will be well, but if it's not, then there will be a sense of unease in the house. And I wonder whether this is what I experienced when I was at a summer school in Manchester, and I was given a room in the student union building where we were all being housed. And I felt intuitively, when I saw the way the bed was followed at one of the walls of the room, and I just felt as I prepared to get into bed that this bed was 90 degrees the wrong way round. And I felt very uneasy. And what I did, it wasn't a very heavy bed, I just turned it 90 degrees. Now, this meant that my feet now were under the sink in the room, because it was a small room, about the size of a telephone kiosk, such as they give students if you're studying in Manchester. But it was, from that point onwards, I was at ease. Now, I'm not going to make anything of it, but I sense that this was my finding the chi, that room as it was planned, as it was outlaid with the furnishings, was not in accordance with that. Certainly, you must know that there are some houses, when you go into them, that you can feel at ease, and others that give you a sense of dis-ease. Well, the Chinese would have no doubt about this. They would say quite simply that the house is either built to take the qi, and feng shui, I suppose, is one modern form of this, a practice, not modern, but become modern to us. It's become very popular in the West, which suggests that you've put things in a certain way in order to bring ease and satisfaction, peace into a household. It is very close, actually, here to Zen, which I was talking about in another lecture, Zen Buddhism. It says that one must begin to use one's intuition the intuition which guides us in so many ways, that some of the greatest, probably the most important decisions that we take in life, such as what job we will do, who we will marry, and so on, are made not out of rational grounds, but through intuition. And Taoism encourages you to discover that intuitive side of your nature. And coming back to Chuang Tzu again, Chuang Tzu himself argued that it is this that really dominates everything one does, and if you've learned how to use it. And the best that you do, you will do intuitively. The best music will be played intuitively without thinking about the method, how you're playing it. The poetry will be appreciated intuitively without having to go through the process of criticizing a poem, breaking it down, its structure, its verse form, its rhythm, its beat, and so on. That you just feel the poem. So similarly, a musician will feel the music. And it is... you're entering into a deeper aspect of your own natures. Well, that is very much the Taoist view, and I just want, before I finish, to just quickly look at another Chinese philosopher, Confucius, but let me just read this section 16 of the Tao Te Ching. It's a passage which I have read many times, and this is a new translation. I'm reading from the translation by Stephen Mitchell, which has really been acclaimed as one that, I mean, I don't know Chinese, so I can't be sure, but acclaimed as one that comes closer than any to capturing the spirit of the original. Because after all, the problem of translating from Chinese, you're translating these hieroglyphics. What does a hieroglyphic mean? If you saw a hand in a mouth, what would you think it meant? Well, it means philosophy. Hand and mouth, what you say should be the same as what you do, and that's philosophy to the Chinese. Now there's a down-to-earth philosophy for you. Anyway, here's section 16 of the Tao Te Ching. Empty your mind of all thoughts. Let your heart be at peace. Watch the turmoil of beings, but contemplate their return. Each separate being in the universe returns to the common source. Returning to the source is serenity. If you don't realize the source, you stumble in confusion and sorrow. When you realize where you come from, you naturally become tolerant, disinterested, amused, kind-hearted as a grandmother, dignified as a king. Immersed in the wonder of the Tao, you can deal with whatever life brings you. And when death comes, you are ready. I would suggest that if you went out and bought a copy of the Tao Te Ching and meditated on each of its short sections over a period of 3 months, I cannot think that anybody's life would not be other than completely transformed or changed. Perhaps completely transformed is too big a claim, but certainly would be changed. Now, more famous than either of the Taoist writers that I've been mentioning is, of course, Confucius. And many people look upon Confucius, who lived in the 6th century BCE, was sort of the yang to the yin of Taoism. That he was concerned with the world as it is governed. He certainly wasn't concerned with spiritual things. Confucius was a very down-to-earth man. He was asked about, what about heaven? And he says, look, there's enough problems on earth without bringing in the problems of heaven. What about spirits? And they said to him, well, we've got enough problems dealing with human beings. Never mind question of dealing with spirits. But he does try to show how the Tao can help relationships, where he said in any relationship there's bound to be one, or almost certain to be, one who is assertive and the other one responsive. And you can't be assertive without somebody to respond, and you can't be a responsive person without something to respond to. So the two need each other, and this is his application in relationships of the yin and the yang. But I think that Confucius's greatest contribution was in recognising that what he called Lee, or deference, I suppose, or propriety is perhaps a better word, propriety, that one should not go over the top in relationships. One should just show consideration to others at all times and not try to be constantly pushing them around. And this is one of the things that Confucius, in his writings, the Analects, which were either by him or by his immediate disciples, deference that lacks propriety becomes servility. Caution without propriety becomes timidity. Courage without propriety becomes rebelliousness. Honesty without propriety becomes rudeness. Now that's rather good. It's just showing how, by following what he would call the way of the yin and yang, which are, of course, the twin forces expressing the qi, which emerges from the Tao, that by following the yin and the yang, you could, shall we say, make a point, win an argument, if you like, without losing a friend. And that is more important than just being able to show that you are cleverer than the person you are arguing the case with. So that is a very one side of his teaching. The other side of Confucius's teaching is, and that propriety, of course, is absolutely archetypally Chinese. You know that nobody should be allowed to lose face. This kind of thing, that you show, address even your criticisms, that you don't belittle the person to whom you are addressing it. The other side, of course, is his word goodwill, that we should be showing compassion towards other people. The word in Chinese is jen, J-E-N. And in this, he was a precursor of other religions, because he really expressed the golden rule. The golden rule, do as you would be done by, but he expressed it in the negative form. Do not do to others what you would not wish them to do to you. And he would argue that this is just living out the yin and the yang, that on the one hand you show propriety, and on the other hand you show generosity of spirit, goodwill. Do not do to others what you would not wish them to do to you. And I have a feeling that, in fact, that's more easily put into practice than the positive side, because I think we're more united in what we dislike than in what we like. After all, if I take absolutely to heart, do unto others as I would be done by, then this coming Christmas I'll give my little 2-month-old new grandson a packet of Condor tobacco. His way of putting it is, I think, universal. And his view is, I think, also very down-to-earth and commonsensical, because he says this goodwill, it reaches first to your family, then to your friends, and then to your associates, and so on. And there are circles, widening circles. And he was rather fierce with some of his followers, who said, well, shouldn't we be trying to love the whole of the human race? And he says, well, this is quite impossible, apart from the fact that you don't meet them all. So it's a bit meaningless, but even if you did meet them all, how can you love everybody the same? After all, he said, if a man says to his wife, I love you, my darling, but I love every other woman in the world just as much, she's not likely to be very impressed with this statement of his ardour. So, again, Confucius is absolutely down to earth, and he's very concerned with applying the sort of Taoist philosophy into the world of politics. People have criticized Taoism because they say, well, it's all very well if you're living in a little village community, then you're trying to harmonize your life with the natural way around you. That's fine, but most of our world is now living in huge cities. We've become politicized, and the Greek word polis means city. So we've become political. And therefore, how does it apply? Well, Confucius was very much involved in politics. He was a very high-ranking civil servant, lost his job because of his frankness and became a full-time teacher travelling the country. And he had lots of wise advice as to how a ruler should rule. One of which is this: if a ruler regards his ministers as his hands and feet, then his ministers will regard him as their heart and mind. If a ruler regards his ministers as dogs and horses, his ministers will regard him as any other man. If a ruler regards his ministers as dirt and grass, his ministers will regard him as a bandit and an enemy. And he really says that the way to apply the Tao is not to take any unnatural action. He says the best ruler is the one who rules according to Wu Wei. The Tao Te Ching itself had said that the best ruler is one who rules like a man cooking a very, very small fish. He does it extremely slowly, extremely gently. And that the best kind of ruling, therefore, is the one that rules least and is more concerned about the character and culture of the people. And Confucius is said to have commended a legendary ruler called Shun, of whom he said to have taken no unnatural action and yet have the empire well governed. Shun was the man. He achieved order without taking action. There was nothing for him to do but to hold himself in a respectful posture and face due south. The ideal leader is a person who so leads those who are following him that when they've done what he's leading them into, they will say, "We did it." And he, if he's an ideal leader, will be satisfied with that. The ability to get others to do things without feeling beholden to you. Can you sense how this whole Taoist philosophy is looking at the subtleties of human behavior, holding back, not wanting to be me all the time, accepting that you're just part of the general scene, and accepting that this is how the world could be if we could take some of these ideas to mind. Confucius himself on government said, and now this, you may say, well, this isn't much in our own time, but we're talking about 2,500 years ago. The purpose of government, he said, is to provide for the welfare and happiness of all its people. Excessive taxation, barbarous punishments, and aggression towards people within the state and beyond should be outlawed, and so on. The leader's role should be not brought about by wealth or breeding, but by integrity and virtue arising from a love of education. Confucius was a prophet whose thinking is still being followed in many parts of China and I think in many parts of the world. His Analects and Advice, in which he's trying to show the application of Taoism in the world of practical affairs, is how it can be done. Well, now, Taoism may sound as though it has nothing to make of it into make it into a particular religion. I would link it along with Zen Buddhism, in saying that we must find this, if you like, the feminine side of our natures, the intuitive side, because intuition is feminine, is yin, rationality is yang. The West has been very concerned with rationality. Rationality is a great thing. The world of scholarship is something that can absorb many of us for a great part of our lives. But we do ourselves less than justice if we follow the rational way to the exclusion of the intuitive. And what Chuang Tzu and Lao Tzu and all the other great Taoist teachers are saying is, if you can discover that side of your nature, then you will begin to understand what it is to be in harmony with the Tao. And to be in harmony with the Tao, however you interpret that, you will know when that is the case. To be in harmony with the Tao is what life is for. Taoism does not offer a world beyond. There is no heaven except as a fictional ideal. There is no heaven in Taoism in the sense that we talk about it in the West. And they don't talk about uniting one's self or soul or spirit with the divine spirit. The Tao remains eternally unknowable. But while we're on earth, if we follow these basic, simple, and yet in many ways very difficult, of course, but basic, simple guides to living, I would say that it's as much as any other philosophy that is being taught, or religion which is being taught in the world today, Taoism has the clue, the key, to the most fulfilled and happy life.